I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. 100 million Americans who were eligible to vote sat out the 2016 presidential election. That's more than voted for either Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton. It's easy to believe that everyone is politically engaged this election year, what with pictures of long lines of voters, round-the-clock news coverage of every campaign event, and utterance by the candidates, new polls tracking campaign ups and downs, heated arguments on social media, and stories about the angry divide between Republicans and Democrats. According to our guest, most Americans are casual observers of politics and completely disengaged from all the political dramas. They don't get much attention for what they do care about and what they don't like about partisans who dominate the conversation. One of the authors of the study joins us on Radio Times. Yana Krupnikov is an associate professor of political science at Stony Brook University, and she joins us on Radio Times. And nice to have you with us on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
There are many ways to divide the country. You do it by looking at this attention divide between people who are, I guess, making politics foreground and people who are making it background. Help us understand this divide.
Well, I think your description of people who make politics foreground versus background is actually an excellent way to look at this. The way that my research conducted with John Barry Ryan, who's also a faculty member at Stony Brook University, looks at it is that we consider how involved people are in politics. And for some people, politics is front and center. It's something that centers their day. It's something that begins their day. They pay a tremendous amount of attention to almost everything that happens. They might feel a bit anxious when they can't follow politics. For other people, it's something that they know is happening, right? It's something that they're aware of. They might know the big events in the news, but they're not really spending a large portion of their day thinking about politics. They're not following every single detail. They're not necessarily waking up to the latest small detail in every single thing that has happened politically.
In fact, as you describe it, most of the country are the people who are not obsessed about what's going on Twitter, for instance. Correct?
Yeah, exactly. Right. So for some people, this is something that is extremely important, something that they're focused on. But for other people, they might watch the news. They might care about who wins the election. I would argue many do, but they're not necessarily on Twitter. They're not refreshing their news feeds. They're not kind of doing those things.
I mean, that seems like a kind of healthy thing to do, to be perfectly honest with you.
Yeah, if we think about anxiety, right, if we think about this 24-hour news cycle, something is always happening. And in 2020, that thing is probably terrible. So if you're basically checking it on almost an hourly basis, you are kind of aware of this every single moment of your day.
When we think about these people, I'm going to just switch out my headphones. I'm having a little bit of a technical problem here. Hold on just one second, Yana, if you don't mind. Hold on one sec. Okay, let's see if that is better. No, not entirely better, but I will carry on. And you call them inattentives, and I feel like there's kind of a negative connotation to that. Is that the right word to describe?
I don't think it is, actually. In our research, we distinguish between this idea of involvement. And we think some people are deeply, deeply involved in politics. These are the people who, as you mentioned, are checking Twitter all the time.
Right.
And there are some people who are less involved. And I don't necessarily think we should put a negative or positive connotation on these patterns. Rather, we see it as just kind of the description of the electorate in the U.S. at this particular moment in time.
But would you say that they just don't like politics? Is that what it is?
I think the way to think about it is that there's some people who have an almost outsized amount of attention to politics.
Right.
Some people for whom politics is really important, for whom their political identities are really important, their partisan identities. They see this conflict. They feel the conflict deeply. I think for other people, this political conflict is not necessarily something that's going to draw them in. They might not like this conflict. They might perceive that this conflict is actually preventing things from happening that might help them. So they perceive politics as becoming too conflictual, too partisan, and I think that's what they don't like.
And would it be fair to say that we're talking about both Republicans and Democrats? When you look at the, you know, the people that make politics background, are they essentially people that might align themselves with either one party or the other? Or are they more agnostic about even party politics?
Well, that's an interesting question, because I think there are two groups here. I think when we're talking about people who are less involved, certainly there are people in that group who would very clearly on a survey, very openly say, I'm a Democrat or I'm a Republican.
Right.
So these are people who actually do have partisan preferences. They actually probably have presidential preferences. They can very obviously tell you, I want Trump or I want Biden. I think there's probably another group that is more likely to describe themselves as independent. But again, it gets a bit more complicated. For this group might actually also have partisan preferences, but might be kind of so tired of partisan politics and partisan arguing that by this point, they don't actually even want to tell you their party. They're kind of just like, ugh, I'm over this. I'm independent. I don't want to associate myself with either one of this group. Though they kind of prefer one party over the other.
Well, so, I mean, it sounds like they're just sick of maybe people like me that talk about politics all the time. Is that a piece of it?
Well, I don't necessarily think they're sick of
me personally. I'm just saying, I mean, I think there is a fair number of people in this country, especially I think in 2020, who think about politics way sports thing. Sports fans think about sports. I mean, it really dominates their life.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think there is some reaction to that, right? I think to the extent that people are sick of something, it's probably somebody that they engage with on an almost daily basis, right? When they go to their Facebook and they had hoped to see cute pictures of cats or babies
right.
And instead see somebody kind of very angry and very frustrated about politics, that might turn somebody off. When they kind of go to the news and in the news they see pictures of people who are angry and who are screaming, that forms an image in their minds of that's how you do politics. Like, that's how you behave when you are a partisan, is that you are very, very angry. And I think for some people, that's not necessarily what they want to be.
Well, and it also sounds like from your research is that this is a sizable, maybe even majority of the population, but they are being ignored or just are not seen as players in this, what feels like much more partisan, angry, divided political season.
Well, I think there is kind of a natural reason why they might not necessarily be seen as players. If we think about what receives news coverage, if we think about what might be interesting for the news to cover, it is conflict. If we're going to cover politics, there's kind of an inherent conflict there. And so you want to give examples of people who are fairly conflictual. So if we look for these examples, we're inevitably going to find people who are deeply involved. It's much less interesting in some sense to interview somebody who's kind of like, well, I want to vote for this candidate, but I'm kind of tired of everything. It doesn't necessarily fit into this context of partisan argument and polarization. Even though this person might be a voter, they might be an important pivotal voter in a given state, even though this person is going to stand in a long line to cast their ballot, even if this person actually does deeply care who wins the presidency, because they're less likely to be vocal, because they're less likely to be angry, their voices are much less likely to be elevated in the news.
You know, it reminds me of Richard Nixon's silent majority that he, you know, this was, of course, decades ago, but just reminds me of how he and others would speak about this more sort of quiet part of the, if not electorate, the public that just doesn't get a lot of attention. Do you see some parallels there?
I wouldn't necessarily connect it in that way to the silent majority. I think in a Nixon sense, he very strongly believed that if the silent majority spoke, they would be in support of him.
Right, true.
And I think here, the voices of these people who are less involved are extremely diverse. They want really kind of different things. Even amongst the Democrats and Republicans in this group. What unites these people is a dissatisfaction with politics and a dissatisfaction with partisan politics. And I think what also unites them is that in this era of the 24-hour news cycle, in this era of social media, in this era of people expressing their views on social media politically quite a bit, they're just not willing to do that.
Yeah.
They might not have the time to do that. They might not be interested in doing that.
Let me read a comment from Dave Yona, who says, I know a lot of people who are not so ideologically uniform with one party or another. An example is a friend of mine who's very pro-gun but also wants to raise the minimum wage. Would that represent this cohort that we're talking about? Does that seem to fit what we're talking about, Yona?
It does in some ways, and it doesn't. So not to get into too much political
science here. We can handle it.
If we think of people who are deeply involved, right, they are constantly plugged into the news. And when you're constantly plugged into the news, you hear what sort of the activist politicians, kind of very vocal members of your party are telling you you are supposed to be like. So if I'm constantly on the news and if I'm constantly on Twitter, somebody is constantly telling me what a good Democrat behaves like, what a good Republican behaves like. These are the cues I get. So then, because I'm so attuned to this, I know exactly how to answer every ideological question to be a good member of my party. And this is something that we have seen in research quite a bit, that people get their cues from the politicians.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Talking with Yona Krupnikov, she's an associate professor of political science at Stony Brook University. We're talking about some really interesting research that looks at the difference between those people who are just obsessed with politics. It just sort of defines and describes their everyday experience, and those that are more on the sidelines and are sort of making politics more in the background. We want to know if that sounds like you. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Talking with Yona Krupnikov. She's an associate professor of political science at Stony Brook University. And talking about some interesting research, looking at the difference between kind of obsessed people who can't kind of get enough of what's happening on Twitter when it comes to politics. And frankly, most of the rest of the population that has just a much more casual relationship with politics, maybe even disengaged. Yona, let me read a comment from Neil. He says, please ask the guests whether they think low voter involvement is partly a result of the perception or reality that big money special interests have overwhelming influence in politics. Also, do big spenders like that Well, let me just leave it at the first question, whether you think there's something about politics that's just kind of a turnoff because there's so much money sloshing around in both parties.
Well, that's a really interesting question from Neil. So earlier, I had a chance to be involved with the Knight Foundation report, the 100 million report on people who don't vote.
Right.
And this is actually one of the questions that was asked of these non-voters. This report had one of the largest samples of non-voters ever. And what's interesting is that certainly these non-voters said that kind of the special interest in money in politics was a turnoff for them. But you know who else said that special interest in turnout was
I think I know the answer to that, yes.
Voters.
Right.
Actually, at, if I recall correctly, maybe even very slightly higher rates. So it's certainly something that if we were to ask on a survey, people would say, but I think it's difficult to pinpoint it exactly to this particular cause.
I'm interested, and again, I guess I'm searching around for that right word, maybe the more sort of disengaged American or voter, whether they see us as perhaps less divided than I think a lot of people see this country, that maybe there is more common ground between people that normally or under certain circumstances or current circumstances look at each other as really the other side or even the enemy.
That's, I think, a really interesting question. When we look at how people perceive America, and we specifically ask, do you perceive this level of polarization? Do you perceive this anger? People do. Even the people who are less deeply involved kind of say that they perceive America as being really divided. In our data amongst Republicans who are less involved, they actually stated divisions as one of the main problems facing the country. So I think they perceive there to be a lot of divisions. Now, why is that?
Is that because
that's what they see? Is that because that's what they see on their television? Is that because these are the images they get? I think that's entirely possible. But they do perceive there to be a lot of division.
I mean, it seems like, broadly speaking, these people, they don't like politics. They don't like angry politics. They don't like people fighting on TV and arguing on TV. Is that correct?
Yes.
Is that pretty true?
Yes, and they don't like talking about politics.
And they don't like talking about politics.
Yeah, they have in a study we did, we actually kind of asked people whether somebody they would be happy if their child married somebody of the opposing party, but we varied whether that person was going to be ideologically extreme or and if that person was going to talk about politics. And actually, it's the talking that mattered much more than the ideological extremity.
Which I found really interesting. So it's okay if a Republican family has a Democratic son-in-law or daughter-in-law, but just don't talk politics.
Just don't talk about it. Yeah.
So assuming this is, you know, a majority of the population, so how do we get them into the conversation?
I think one thing that kind of has emerged to me is who we see around us as being political. I don't know about you. I've talked to a lot of people, usually strangers on flights,
right.
who find out what I do for a living.
Pick your brain, right.
Yeah. And the first thing they say to me is, I'm not political. I'm not political at all. And the question that I often have for them is that, are you not political? Do you genuinely not care what's happening in politics, or do you not want to have a political fight? Because I think those are two really different things. And I think if people start seeing kind of more moderate voices or kind of a less deliberate partisan arguing around them, it might bring them back in a bit more.
Well, that does put a little bit of then the onus on the press, the media, right? I mean, is to feature people like this rather than the pugilists.
I would agree with that. There's recently been a group of communication scholars who've put out a set of suggestions for the media in covering the election. And actually, one of the suggestions is, in fact, feature more moderate voices. Don't search for the extremes on either side to represent public opinion.
Is that boring?
You know, it is probably quite boring. But I would hope that members of the press, who I think are immensely talented, could find a way to cover it in a way that makes it engaging. And in fact, I think your next guest, who is a reporter for The New York Times, does that quite well.
Well, in fact, we'll be talking to her in just a moment or two. Let me get Dale from Landenburg, Pennsylvania, to join our conversation. And Dale, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thanks very much for the show.
You're welcome.
The question is, I mean, could the fact that two parties connive together with the media to make it a two-party system, that they cooperate on the big things like lots of wars, lots of enemies, need for spying, and they conspire to make it difficult for third parties. They conspire to make it impossible to have ranked choice voting. Could it possibly be that reasonable people are turned off by this?
Well, that's an interesting question. What do you think, Jana?
Well, there's certainly a number of institutional structures in American politics that make it difficult for a third party to emerge. I think another thing to consider, though, is that we often think of people who call themselves independent or moderate as this third group that could produce a third party. But actually, again, it's a very diverse group of people who might be united by a dislike of politics or partisanship, but they're not exactly unified by similar political opinions.
And what is the difference? Well, I'm going to shift gears in just a moment or two, but independent voters or even undecided voters and the people that we've been talking about, what do you see as the cardinal differences between these groups?
Yeah, so when we think about the people I'm talking about who are less involved, these are just people who don't spend every hour, are not fixated and focused on politics. People who are independent are people, and I'm choosing my words very deliberately here, are people who are not willing to tell us on a survey what party they are. It does not mean that they actually don't have a party. It means they aren't willing to tell us what their party is, but might actually have really strong attachments to partisanship. And people who are undecided are just people who aren't telling us in a survey what candidate they're going to vote for. So that group of people who aren't involved is a very large group. The independents are a somewhat smaller group in surveys. And this particular election, the undecideds are actually a very, very small group.
I was just going to ask you about that. I mean, we're talking about a couple of percentage points when you look at some of these polls and surveys.
Yeah, so we have fewer undecideds, as I think right now, than we did in 2016, for sure. It's a very, very small group. Independence goes up and down. Typically, in every election, the number of people who say they're independent does shrink, just because more people suddenly are willing to say they're members of a party. We've seen kind of a plurality of American voters say they're independent. I think the highest I've seen it is about 35-38% on some surveys. But those numbers do move around quite a bit, actually, depending on how you ask people about it.
And just final question before we have to say goodbye. Do you think 2020 is an outlier just because of just the intensity of our political disagreements?
So what I've seen from surveys and data is that for survey companies that have been asking how much do you care about the outcome of this election, this is one of the highest points we've seen.
Wow.
And so I just kind of want to emphasize that just because somebody isn't following politics every day, every hour, doesn't mean that they don't care and doesn't mean that they aren't, in some cases, going to risk their lives to cast votes. There's a big difference between not knowing what the latest tweet is on a topic and being entirely disengaged from politics.
Well, we're going to leave it there. Jana Krupnikov, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. She's an associate professor of political science at Stony Brook University. Well, we were just talking about disengaged voters who are only casually interested in the rough and tumble of electoral politics, but now non-voters. 4 years ago, something like 3.5 million Pennsylvanians who were eligible to vote sat out the 2016 presidential election. And as it turned out, Pennsylvania was a deciding state that year, with Donald Trump beating Hillary Clinton by just 44,292 votes. Will 2020 be any different? There are many reasons people don't vote. They don't like the candidates. They don't think voting makes a difference. It's too hard to vote on a Tuesday. Joining us is Sabrina T. Tavernisi. She's a reporter for the New York Times. In fact, just did a story about non-voters in Pennsylvania, and she joins us by Skype. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. And here with us in our Philadelphia studios across the shower curtain from me is WHYY reporter Miles Bryan, who also did a story about Pennsylvanians who don't vote. And Miles, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And to our listeners, we want to hear from you, especially if you are one of those non-voters. Tell us why. Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call us. Again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Sabrina, let me begin with you and just with a broad-based question about in 2016, 100 million eligible voters did not vote. Help us understand the non-voters and what keeps them from the polls.
Yeah, so essentially, you know, this has been kind of a persistent problem in the American political system since really kind of the turn of the 20th century. There's between a third and a half of eligible voters don't vote in American election in presidential elections, which is a very, very high number if you compare the United States to its developed peers in Europe. And, you know, essentially, these are folks who feel very disengaged from the political system. There's this sense of powerlessness of there's also some sense of sort of, you know, it's rigged. This is kind of a political class up there that does its own thing and sort of, you know, every 4 years asks us for our vote. But really nothing in my life ever changes. And I guess I would want to I do want to point out that there's a pretty serious class divide in who votes now in the United States. And, you know, obviously voting has been pretty complicated in terms of large portions of the American population left out in periods of history, women, Black Americans. But there did tend to be more of a mixing of classes in earlier periods where turnout was higher, which I thought was interesting in doing this story.
In fact, you found that for people making $150,000 or more, three quarters of them voted, and that was just hugely more numbers than people who were at the lower end of the income spectrum.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, you know, it's when you're just out there kind of walking around talking to people, yeah. If you're talking to college graduates, it's pretty hard to find someone who's not going to vote. Whereas if you're talking to people who are in poorer families or people without college degrees, it's a much higher proportion.
Let me turn to you, Miles, and you did a piece recently looking at Pennsylvanians and those who had decided not to vote. They might vote in 2020, but certainly they have not in the past. Help us understand the people you talked to.
Yeah, I talked to a lot of folks here in Pennsylvania about why they didn't vote in 2016. Some are planning to vote now. And something that stood out to me that came up a bit in the New York Times piece is, you know, folks who don't make as much money are often less likely to vote. But in some survey data I looked at of Pennsylvania non-voters put up by Susquehanna University, a lot of the people who didn't vote in 2016 did express some interest in politics and basically gave as an answer to why they didn't vote some kind of personal reason. You know, their kids were sick. They couldn't get the time off. They got confused about their polling place. They didn't register in time. And, you know, I think it's hard to sort of delineate super clear groups of people, you know, who are non-voters. I think a lot of this sort of runs together. But I was surprised in my reporting to find that I think a lot of people who don't vote are somewhat interested in if we made it easier to vote in this country, in this state, if we maybe made Election Day a national holiday or something like that, you might see more of those folks be able to vote.
Does that make sense to you, Sabrina?
Yes, completely. Miles, you're totally right. It's really, really varied, varied group of folks. You know, people don't vote for all sorts of reasons. And a lot of times also people go in and out of the political system. Many people I interviewed hadn't voted in years and then voted for Barack Obama in 2008. Others hadn't voted in years and voted for Donald Trump for the first time in 2016. So, you know, it sort of depends, I think, for people also on, you know, is there a candidate that really does inspire you? Mm-hmm. I think there was some Pew data after the 2016 election that showed that the highest proportion of non-voters giving the reason that they just didn't like either of the candidates, which was very unusual. 2016 was unusual in that way. Usually people say, I didn't have time or I wasn't interested, but this was very much about dislike of both of the candidates.
Well, let me play Melissa Durko. This is someone, Miles, that you talked to for your piece. She's a Philadelphia non-voter, and here she is describing what it would take to get her to vote.
I think that if we were no longer in a two-party system, and we were able to have multiple candidates, that I would consider voting, especially if there were like a lot of candidates that had a lot of, you know, different views than the two that we're dealing with now, which are, it's basically the same person with two different masks. That's all that it is right now. So I think that the entire political system would need to be dismantled and start everything over again.
I mean, Miles, it's interesting. I mean, these are two, I have to say, two very different candidates, but from her perspective, she doesn't see that.
Yeah, I mean, she's someone who's committed to not voting, to not taking part in the system. And I would think about her as somebody who's basically unwilling to accept any form of the lesser of two evils argument. I mean, that came up a lot in 2016. It comes up a lot now. I think she would classify herself as progressive in the sense she wants socialized healthcare, state-sponsored healthcare, for example. But she's just not willing to vote for someone who doesn't fully represent her. And I did talk to a number of people who haven't voted in the past or are not voting now, who said something similar, that they don't see any point in, you know, just sucking it up and voting for someone they didn't fully endorse, because why would they do that?
Oh, it's so interesting. Let me read an email from Bruce, who says a very large percentage of Americans are so fed up with the chicanery, the corruption, the lying of non-qualified and only in it for themselves candidates and partisan fighting that they have given up. Sabrina, we're almost up on a break here, but from your reporting, does that square with some of the people you talk to, which is that they just think the system is so riddled with corruption, they don't want any parts of it?
Exactly. How is it possible that these, you know, all of these Congress people, they have all this money? You know, what's that about? Why? So my life hasn't changed at all since the 1970s. And here they come every year, every 4 years asking for this. And, you know, they've changed. I haven't. And what's the point in participating in that? Which, you know, it has some not exactly constructive, but
there it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. That's Sabrina Tavernese. She's a reporter for The New York Times. Also with us is Miles Bryan, reporter for WHYY. We are talking about non-voters. We've got much more after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and we are spending the second half of the show today talking about non-voters, why people do not vote. And if that is you, we want to hear from you. RadioTimes@WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Let me play another clip, and this is from some of Miles Bryan's reporting. This is Robert Giovanni of Lebanon County, Pennsylvania. He did not vote in 2016 because he mistakenly thought he was not eligible because he was a formerly incarcerated person. Let's give it a listen.
I was talking with one of the county commissioners here where I live about different issues. And he goes, well, why don't you vote? And I said, I'm not allowed. And he goes, well, yes, you are. And I'm like, excuse me? He goes, all because you're a felon, that don't mean you're not allowed to vote. At that point, I went and registered.
Miles, tell us about Robert Giovanni.
Yeah, Robert Giannavetti Lebanon County resident. You know, he grew up in a Pittsburgh steel family, you know, all union Democrats. In 2016, he was taken by Trump's rhetoric around bringing the steel industry back. But like you said, he had a felony from a couple of years ago. And he had just thought he lost his right to vote, and he never really looked into it. And, you know, that might sound like an uncommon case, but there are hundreds of thousands of people here in Pennsylvania who have felony convictions on their record. most of those people are eligible to vote. And I found, you know, a lot of them don't know that. I think that's one example of people who just aren't really aware, don't have the knowledge they need to be able to vote. And now Giannavetti plans to vote for Trump, his first vote of his life this year.
Wow.
And I just want to add, you know, the New York Times has done great reporting on how President Trump, to win Pennsylvania, is really hoping to bring out more first-time non-college voters like Giannavetti to make up for losing, you know, votes in the suburbs.
But it, I mean, it raises a whole host of questions, which is just the mechanics of voting. The people, they don't understand it, or they haven't, it hasn't been explained to them in a way that really makes sense in their lives.
Yeah, you know, I was out a couple of days ago in Southwest Philly. A lot of African immigrants live there, and I talked to this young woman who had become a citizen a couple of months ago. She's from Nigeria. She was really excited about voting for the first time until I told her that the date to register had passed.
Right.
And, you know, I saw her face fall, and she's like, look, I'm a single mom. I've got kids. I'm in nursing school. Coronavirus is happening. There's you know, trouble back home in Nigeria. Like, how am I supposed to you know, figure all this stuff out? And it just brings home how we do put up a lot of informational and just sort of practical barriers to voting in this country.
Sabrina, let me turn back to you and actually turn back to the piece that you did about Pennsylvania. You began with a woman named Kayana Frederick. She lives in East Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania. Tell us about Kayana.
So Kayana was an example, kind of similar, I think, to Miles, the person, the young woman you talked to at the beginning that you played the clip of. She essentially has she voted for Obama in 2008. She's African American, but she sort of feels like she had this phrase, you know, the parties are like two wings on the same bird, she doesn't really see a huge difference between kind of outcomes in terms of the two political parties. Now, she's 31. She has she works in a hotel and also a department store. She's had many relatively low wage jobs. She's feeling super frustrated that she is kind of started college, didn't finish it, feels like she's stuck in debt, and is just kind of doesn't really see the Democratic Party offering her anything, and doesn't really see evidence of a hopefulness in participating in the political process. And the interesting contrast was with her parents, both African Americans born in the 1950s, both in the American South, saw ample evidence that voting could actually make a big difference in their lives. And they were having an ongoing argument about that. They couldn't believe that their daughter would not vote. She did not change her position.
Interesting family discussion there. Let me read some more comments. One from Lucy. She says, I disagree with the description of independence from the earlier guests as people just afraid to declare their choice and using it as a mask. I've been independent for decades. I want to judge the merits of candidates in each election, just not on their party affiliation. That's fine, Lucy. Here's a tweet. I wonder how engagement would change if we focus less on politics and more on policy. These are two different concepts, but they seem to obsess over politics, which are abstract and problem focused, whereas policy is more pragmatic and solutions focused. Let me turn back to you, Miles. The people that you talk to, do they want more information or more conversation, less about horse races and more about where does someone stand when it comes to immigration or healthcare or all the policy differences and disagreements that are out there? Hard to know.
You know, I'm just thinking about that question, and I feel like the answer is just I don't think there's a clear answer. I think talking to non-voters, something that came home for me is people's ideological beliefs are not always internally, you know, similar. They don't always add up and make sense. You know, if somebody will say, you know, I like President Trump, he says it like it is, but also, you know, I think he's racist, and you know, but Joe Biden, I don't know about how I feel about him, and it was difficult to sort of figure out what sort of information people could receive that would then lead to them to vote. I think what stood out to me is that, you know, these are people who you know, like Sabrina's article put it so well, are dealing with sort of bread and butter issues. They're dealing with what's right in front of their face a lot of the time. They're dealing with logistical hurdles that are just sort of keeping them from the polls. So I think bringing those folks in, I think a way to be more practically successful with that would just be to make it easier.
Right.
I mean, just to make it more accessible.
Well, I'm picking up, Sabrina, when you wrote about non-voters and you focused largely on Pennsylvania, they tend to be more low income. Just picking up on what was said earlier, they tend not to be college graduates. They tend to be single parents and more likely to be unemployed. I mean, these are people that you know, need the policies that often come from a government, you know, whether the government does it or not. Can you flesh that out for us?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so, which is the thing that makes it so frustratingly tragic, because these are the people who need the policy the most. And they are the people who are the least, participating the least. And I guess the thing I would say, sort of in a sense, in their defense, you know, their lives are really complicated. Some of the people were in homeless shelters. There were bunches of single moms who had to drop out of the labor force because they couldn't get childcare. I mean, these are people who were saying, it's Wednesday, I have an emergency on Friday. You know, how is this going to help? I mean, there's a real sense of disconnect between kind of what's happening out there and their lives. And, you know, I think in some ways politics has become, you know, more tribal, more kind of about who you are and identity, and less about stuff, you know? Mm. And I think that is not very appealing when the person isn't that into politics, as the previous guest, Yana, so artfully explained. You know, there's a huge portion of the population in the United States that isn't opening up their phone in the morning to see, you know, what 538 says, that isn't on Twitter, and that is trying to solve the immediate problems of their lives, which are pretty acute. And so it's not really enough to say I'm part of the winning blue or red team. They don't actually care about that much.
Well, and is it because those teams are so self-defined now, and so the people in the middle are sort of left trying to figure out which team do I belong to? Miles, go ahead.
I do want to add, and I think this is probably true in Pennsylvania and nationwide, that, you know, there's this huge, like you said, an unprecedented interest in this election. And something I heard talking to folks for this story was, for just, you know, a good number of the non-voters I spoke to in 2016 said they were coming around in 2020. Something had pushed them sort of off the sideline and they wanted to cast a vote. You know, I talked to a young woman named Avery Johnson, who was 25. She didn't vote in 2016, didn't see it sort of making a difference in her life. But, you know, she lives in West Philadelphia. In the last couple of years, you know, she's had a son, and she's also seen a lot of gun violence in the neighborhood she lives in. And there's just this sort of endless kind of chaos. And, you know, what she described as hurtful language from President Trump has, you know, pushed her to take the time to register to vote. She got her boyfriend registered to vote, and they're voting. And I did hear that quite a bit, that this election, the noise is so loud that maybe it is pushing some people who might not otherwise have ever been interested.
Sabrina, did you find that?
I did. Yes, I found quite a number of people, actually, who hadn't voted either for years or certainly not in 2016, and were planning on voting this time. In fact, the final woman in my story, Latoya Garrison, was very much motivated to vote, despite the fact that she's African-American, works in a factory doing putting seals on cosmetics. Has three kids, you know, single mom, really struggling to pay the rent. But she said, you know, COVID has just completely collapsed my life. I mean, you know, she lost her waitressing job. She's really struggling. And she said, I just want anybody who is going to, you know, change what is going on with COVID in the United States right now. And I think probably the best person is Joe Biden. So over the objection of her Trump supporting mother and father-in-law, she went and cast her vote for Joe Biden.
Interesting. Let me read some more comments. One from Margaret: to what extent would stronger civics education and requirements for civic service in schools and society contribute to higher voter participation? election. An email from Kathy: do non-voters understand that their local vote is important? Down-ballot elections can have an impact on politics up the line. A comment from Tanya from East Norriton: one of the reasons people don't vote is because of the electoral system, actually, show we did yesterday, and they know their vote may not count. So we, as you were saying, Miles, there are many, it feels like, impediments to voting. And it is interesting that in 2020, we're still going to vote on a Tuesday. It's not a national holiday. I mean, you know, talk about, and seeing these long lines. I mean, on the one hand, it's very inspiring to see all this enthusiasm for voting. On the other hand, who can stand in line for 3 hours to cast their vote if they have children, if they have a job? I mean, I'm thinking of all the things that people have to do in their lives.
Yeah, I was at the polls on Sunday. It was a gray, rainy day. It took 2.5 hours for me to make my way through the line and cast a mail-in ballot. And the folks working said they'd been turning away dozens of people the last couple of days at the end of the day because the station shut down and they hadn't made their way up to the line. And so they mentioned one woman who'd come every day after work around 4 for the last 3 days, and she still hadn't been able to vote. Mm. I mean, that's
just wrong.
It's completely anecdotal, yeah. But I do think there's a lot of truth there where it's like, how much does this abstract thing mean to you, you know, to take time away from your kids, off work, away from making money, away from buying groceries, to just go stand in line to do this thing?
Well, and I wonder, Sabrina, whether, and we're seeing, you know, a lot of people using the mails to cast their ballot. Do you think once we kind of figure out some of the glitches and questions about mail-in voting, whether that will make it easier for people to vote and perhaps even non-voters will see this as an option because they won't have to stand in line?
Yes, potentially. We, of course, don't know what is going to be the fate of all of this after Election Day. So I think it's still, we still have to kind of wait and see. We might not have a very good experience with this in the end, but certainly that would be helpful.
Here's a comment from Harold from Drexel Hill. This is so infuriating, the fact that so many people don't vote. It's their civic duty. If they don't vote, how can you complain about the two-party system or being disenfranchised? And while I understand Harold's fury, on the other hand, what I hear from you, Miles, and also Sabrina, is that there are people who want to vote, but, you know, but we make it hard to vote, and that's why we've got so many non-voters.
Yeah, and just one more thing I want to add is that we do have a system in this country. People who are frustrated and say it's one person with two masks, I think there's an element of truth in that we have set up a two-party system where there's no way for minority groups to find representation in a smaller party in the way that a parliamentary system like in England or in other parts of Europe can represent groups of people, you know, where you can be part of, say, a green party that ends up wielding power even though there's not that many of you because you're in a coalition. I think it does, you know, beat people down to have to constantly swallow down their beliefs and just vote for somebody they don't even like that much because it's not as bad in their opinion as the other person. I mean, I think we have to acknowledge there's an element of truth in that criticism.
And to you, Sabrina, it sounds like you want to say something. Go ahead.
Yes, I just wanted to second what Miles was saying. If you look back historically to the late 19th century, there were many, many parties in the American political system. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, there were large classes of Americans who were completely left out. But again, there was much higher participation among poor and working class people in that period of American history.
Let me ask you, Sabrina, do you see either President Trump or former Vice President Biden reaching out or wooing some of these non-voters? Do you see efforts on their behalf?
Well, you know, there've been much made of the idea by Democrats that, you know, non-voters are the real swing voters. And, you know, in my reporting, and it sounds like also in Miles' reporting very much so, there's some truth in that. You know, people who didn't vote in 2016, certainly lots of them that I talked to who were planning to vote this year were going to vote for Biden. I'm not sure that they're necessarily reaching out so much to them. I mean, my experience with them, you know, again, this is sort of cartooning it, but they are less kind of interested in the sort of team sport aspect and more interested in what is the practical effect on my life.
Yeah, Miles, almost out of time, but go ahead. You got the final
word. Just one note on, you know, reaching out to those folks. the biggest predictor of whether you're going to vote is, you know, if you've been voting consistently in the past, right? So I think campaigns that are trying to win and use their resources as efficiently as possible, they want to reach these folks, but they're also focused on the people they know come out to the polls every year and making sure they vote. So it's a system that's not set up for a lot of resources to go to the non-voter.
Well, we have to leave it there. My thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Miles Bryan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And he's a reporter here at WHYY. Sabrina Tavernese, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. She's a reporter for The New York Times. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show, which you can get wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.